Amen.
Thank you, Paul. Would you take your Bible and turn to Galatians in chapter 2? First 10 verses is where our focus will be, and so if you don't mind, I'm going to have you stand one more time, if you can. If you can't, remain seated, but those who can, would you please, all right? First 10 verses. Then after an interval of 14 years, I, Paul, went up again to Jerusalem with Barnabas, taking Titus along also. It was because of a revelation that I went up and I submitted to them the gospel which I preach among the Gentiles, but I did so in private to those who were of reputation or who have great influence, for fear that I might be running or had run in vain. But not even Titus, who was with me, though he was a Greek, was compelled to be circumcised, but it was because of the false brothers secretly brought in, who had sneaked in to spy out our liberty, that which we have in Christ Jesus, in order to bring us into slavery. But we did not yield in subjection to them for even an hour, so that the truth of the gospel would remain with you. Now, as you look at verse 6 to 10 in the Greek text, this is one sentence. As I checked all of your English Bibles that are here, the punctuation is totally different. It's a very difficult grammatical sentence. You follow along as I'm reading from NASB. But from those who were of influence, makes no difference to me, God shows no partiality. While those who were of influence contributed nothing to me, but on the contrary, seeing that I had been entrusted with the gospel for the uncircumcised, just as Peter for the circumcised. For he who effectually worked for Peter in his apostleship to the uncircumcised worked effectually for me also to the Gentiles. And they, recognizing this, that is the grace which had been given to me, James, Cephas, and John, who were of influence, even as pillars, gave to me and Barnabas the right hand of fellowship, so that we might go to the Gentiles and they to the circumcised. But they did ask us to remember the poor, the very thing that I am eager to do. Thank you. You may be seated. I love to read biographies, especially autobiographies, where the author himself or herself is writing about an experience of life. So I just went over to my library and just picked out a couple of autobiographies that speak to me for different reasons, like the autobiography of Peter Cartwright, one of the great circuit riding preachers, a committed Arminian who would not at all baptize converts because baptism was not for this age. And yet, as I read about Peter Cartwright and his incredible influence of the gospel, it thrilled my heart. Or to pick up the journal of John Wesley and to read this journal, which I've done on two occasions. It ministers to my soul as he shares his burden. Brilliant mind as he rode thousands of miles via horseback to preach the gospel, and he had his Greek and Hebrew text, and he would let the horse just go as he reading through his Greek text, put it in, pull out his Hebrew text, and was so burdened that people would understand the original languages that he ended up writing grammars for children for the Greek as well as for the Hebrew. An amazing, brilliant man of God. A guy like Charles Spurgeon, who has a two-volume autobiography, The Early Years and the Harvest Years. As you read through that, which I've done at least on one occasion, possibly more, I just think of the incredible man that God used, who at age 19 was pastoring the second largest church in all of London. I think of the autobiography of John G. Patton, To the New Hebrides Islands, and this sadness and the tears that will flow from you as you read about the death of his wife and children, and how he had to sleep on the graves so the cannibals would not come that night and dig them up and eat them. Most incredible things that people have gone through. I loved, most recently, Dr. Leonard gave to me one of his favorite books, Jonathan Edwards by Ian Murray. And the beauty of this book is, as I read it, was that there's page after page of personal letters that he wrote to people and people wrote to him, so that you begin to really see his heartbeat. There's something about the personal handwriting of men and women that when you read, your heart just resonates and it just shouts out. You feel their pain. You feel the weakness. You rejoice when the good things are happening to them. Your heart is just filled with great joy. And that's how I feel when I turn to the book of Galatians. It's a letter. The book of Galatians is a letter, the very first letter written by an apostle who was one born out of due time, is how he stipulates it in Corinthians. He's one who was not part of the original 12, but that God carved out of Jewish ethnicity and background to become the apostle to the Gentiles, to the nations, to the heathen, if you will. And so when I look at these 10 verses in front of me, I say, now how can I communicate to you the significance of these 10 verses? And so what has come to my mind is this, is I need to at least help you in three different ways. Number one, I want to help you understand how this passage fits within the context of all of Galatians. And the second thing I need to do is not just how it fits, but I want you to understand what it says and what it means. But I'm not done there. As we can go through this fairly quickly, and I hope we do, because I also want to know, how does this actually apply to us today? I mean, all the songs that we have been singing have been fashioned around this particular text. When you think of the God of compassion, when you think of our hope and the solid footing on which we stand and people who need help. See, most of us want to turn people who are not like us into people like us. We want them to be Baptists. We want them to have a home like us. We want them to think like us. We want them to have the same views as us politically. And that has nothing to do with Christianity. It's all about turning people to Jesus. And we've missed that. We're more in tune with religion than we are in relationship with Jesus Christ. So the application of this is significant. So I want to get there, but before I get there, I must begin with how we see this particular passage as it fits together and what it actually means for us today. Because when I see how the passage fits, we looked at the first five verses, and this is the introduction of Paul. And this introduction of Paul is an introduction to the Galatian churches, and it's an amazing introduction because he spends so much time on his prayer wish, as we saw there in verse 3 and verse 4 of chapter 1. And Christ gave himself for our sins that he might rescue us from this present evil age. So an incredible introduction. The second thing that we learned in the next paragraph was how Paul had a burden for churches and the churches that he started. And when you look at verse number 6, he says, I am amazed that you are so quickly deserting him who called you by the grace of Christ to a different gospel, which really isn't another gospel. You're moving away from him. You're moving from God. When you move from the gospel of grace, you are moving from God. Do you understand this, Paul writes? Paul's burden for the church is that they understand the significance of the gospel of grace. So if you just look with me at verse 11 and 12, just the last two verses there from this section, he said, for I would have you know, brothers, that the gospel which is preached by me is not according to man. It's not of human origin. I didn't receive it from man through tradition. I wasn't taught it by man through education, but I received it through revelation. And I take this of Jesus Christ as a genitive that is subjective, a revelation that is from Jesus Christ. It's not from man, it's from Christ himself. This is what I am sharing with you, the gospel. Now, we could go right from here to chapter 3 and verse 1. Just turn over to chapter 3 and verse 1, because that's exactly the mind of Paul. You foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you from this gospel. before whose eyes Jesus Christ was publicly portrayed and crucified. So you could actually jump from chapter 1, verse 12, to chapter 3 and verse 1, and you not miss Paul's thought. But what you would miss are three significant personal illustrations. This is the beauty of Paul writing a letter. We see inside him. And when you look at these particular significant events in Paul's life, you see three personal illustrations. And we looked at one last time. Illustration 1 was chapter 1 from verse 13 to the end of chapter 1. And this illustration was important. And I said to you last time that the gospel changes lives, and Paul was going to be exhibit A to this, I don't think we understand that the mindset of the first century. You see, religion can change people. To be a proselyte in the first century was a Gentile who went through proselytizing baptism, who publicly renounced his way of life as a Gentile. He comes up out of the water in front of all people. He's saying, listen, the way I was brought up by my mom and dad, the way I've lived my life, the way I was educated, this is no good. I turned my back on all of it. I now am going to be a proselyte. I am going hard after the Jewish law. I'm going hard after the Jewish Sabbath. I'm going hard after Jewish dietary food laws. My life is going to be totally separate from what it was before. There was radical change, men and women. There is radical change. So when a Gentile became a Jew in the first century, it was through the proselytizing baptism, and it affected everything. I was reading when I was doing my dissertation years ago, back in the late 80s, early 90s, and I remember reading from the Harvard Theological Review about the way proselytizing baptism took place and what that meant to someone who was considered a citizen of Rome, and how in actuality he was turning his back on his government, he's turning his back on everything that he held dear, and this could even be death to some people. I mean, it's transforming. So the Apostle Paul is going to ask a question theoretically, and that's this: does the gospel of grace really transform? And he's going to give an answer to that from his own personal testimony. This is how I live, and this is what the gospel did to me. And the last verse of chapter 1 is God is being glorified in my life. I mean, that is an amazing transformation. The transformation of people of the first century as they went through proselytizing baptism was that, look at my acts. Look at what I'm doing. Look at the laws I'm keeping. Look at my new relationships. Look how I turned my back on this. And look at me, 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 me. But the transforming power of the gospel is, look at God. It's a great difference. You see, people say, look at my church. Wrong statement. Look at my God. Right statement. So in this first illustration, Paul is going to address the issue that would be on minds in the first century, and that is, why do I need a radical transformation? I see that all the time when people who are Gentiles convert to Judaism. I see radical transformation. Yeah, you see externals. I'm talking about internal, where God is glorified. And Paul becomes exhibit A to that. The second one is this illustration here in these first 10 verses of chapter 2. And here, this is a very important 10 verses, because basically it's this: is the gospel of Christ the same? Is the gospel of Christ, the gospel of grace, is it the same for all peoples? Is it the same for Gentiles as well as Jews? Or do we have to sort of twist it a little bit to get the Gentiles in, or to get the Jews in? I mean, is it the same for all people? And Paul is going to use an illustration of how he actually goes to Jerusalem 14 years after his conversion and has a face-to-face, heart-to-heart with the leadership of Jerusalem to make sure that we all understand that the gospel of grace must be the same for Gentiles and Jews. It must be the same for all people, or I'm running in vain. It's got to be the same. It's the same for generations. For young people, it's got to be the same for old people. It's got to be the same for the middle age. It's got to be the same for no matter what ethnicity you are. It must be the same, or I'm running in vain. And then the last one that we'll look at, which will be in a few weeks, will be after Easter, actually, when we get to it. The last one we're going to look at is, can the gospel of grace withstand internal conflict? Because Paul is going to have to confront Peter over the issue of the gospel of grace, because Peter and the leadership of the church at Antioch are now starting to depreciate the gospel of grace and sort of lean towards the Jewish dietary laws that they were brought up with. And Paul says that's hypocrisy. It cannot be. So here we have a passage in front of us. It's the second personal illustration of the Apostle Paul in chapter 2. And when you look at this particular text, I just want you, there'll be nothing behind me on PowerPoint, because I want you to follow the text and just look at the text very quickly as we work through, because we want to get to what this text applies, how it applies to us. Well, let's see what it means. The first two verses are significant. The first word is then. If you look back at chapter 1, verse 21, then. Verse 18 of chapter 1, then. You have this chronology taking place. From the time I was saved, 118, 3 years later, I made my first trip to meet Peter. Verse 21 of chapter 1. Then I went and ministered in the regions of Syria and Cilicia. And chapter 2, verse 1, then, 14 years after my conversion, I now go up to Jerusalem with Barnabas, and I take Titus along as well. We make our way to Jerusalem. This will parallel in the book of Acts, Acts chapter 11. In Acts chapter 11, Paul has been brought to Antioch, preaching the gospel. Things are taking place at Antioch. They're first called Christians, and then chapter 2, verse 2 of Galatians, by a revelation, I go up to Jerusalem from Antioch. There's a revelation of Christ. Was it the revelation from Agabus? I don't know. Was it a personal revelation? It doesn't say. It just says that the Spirit of God made it very clear that I am supposed to go there to Jerusalem. So he says in verse 2, I went up. And when I go up, there's been something burning on his heart, because he has been in Antioch for an entire year, and he has been developing the gospel of grace, and for the first time, people are called Christians. For the first time, that's Acts chapter 11, verse 26. They're now called Christ followers, because everything about the gospel of grace makes you look like Jesus. It makes you look like Christ. You want to go hard after Jesus. This is what grace does for us. Grace is not legislation. Grace is the Spirit of the Son of Christ, chapter 4, verse 4, living within us. And as he lives within us, he moves us to our new Father. So we cry out, Abba, Father. That's Galatians 4, 4 to 6. I mean, this is what is happening theologically, personally. And so as he sees this happen, as the Spirit moves us towards the Father, think of this triunity, the Spirit within, moving us to the Father, and everybody says we look like Jesus. We're Christians. This is an amazing thing about the triunity. We don't understand it. We can't get our arms fully around it, but we certainly believe it. So the Spirit's within, the Spirit's conforming us to Jesus Christ, moving us to our new Father, and the whole world out. The only thing I can say the world says is that these people look like Jesus. So when I look at the significance of what is taking place here in Galatians chapter 2, verses 1 and 2, Paul is going to submit to them, and that's not the normal term, submit, like husbands and wife relationship. It's a different term. It's a term of, it's only found twice in the New Testament, here and once in Acts, where you find Festus is going to lay before King Agrippa the problem with Paul. So he brings Paul before King Agrippa. It's the only two times you find this particular verb, anatitheme. You find this verb, and this verb has the idea of a declaration to be made, and there is a consequence to this declaration. There is a conclusion to this declaration. And as Paul submits this to the leadership of Jerusalem, it's not because there's something faulty in the gospel. He submits it because after being in ministry now for 14 years, and especially the last year at Antioch, he is absolutely committed to the fact that we're going to have a division in this world between a gospel that's tapered after the Jew and the gospel that's tapered after the Gentile, and we need to bring this together. So in verse 2, by revelation, the Spirit making clear to the Apostle Paul, then he was Saul still, but transformed, the Spirit making clear to the Apostle Paul that he must make his way to Jerusalem to have a face-to-face, a heart-to-heart talk with the leadership, the influential leaders called pillars in this text, of those who are in Jerusalem. So he gives himself to this, as the text says. And notice what he says here in verse 2. I did this how? In private. This is not Acts 15 where there's a public demonstration of the gospel of grace. This is a private issue. And this fits well with what Jesus said. Jesus said in Matthew 18, when you see a brother struggling in some particular issue, what do? Do something public or do something private? You just do it privately. I mean, there you have a principle upon which the gospel works, and that is this, that each of us, Romans 15:14, each of us are full of knowledge and full of goodness, and we are able to nutheteo one another. We are able to counsel one another. You are able to counsel people. But you've got to go face to face and eyeball to eyeball. It's not emails. It's not on the telephone. Skype is close. But it's going face to face with somebody, heart to heart. I mean, to pick up their heartbeat as you talk with them, to listen to them, to watch their inflections. And as they reflect in their face what you are saying to them, you are now beginning to connect with them. We live in a society that loves to do everything in a virtual way, and the church is imploding. Because we no longer see the necessity of going heart to heart and eyeball to eyeball. I say to you, men and women, that we must take what the Apostle Paul is doing here. And you might say, well, he just didn't have email in those days. He could have saved himself a lot of time. I don't think so. I think the issue is the Apostle Paul in private goes to those who are of great influence. Some of your translations almost make it look like Paul's looking down on Peter and Cephas and John. The only time John is mentioned at all by the Apostle Paul in all 13 of his books is right here. But he wouldn't be looking down on them. He needs them. And I love how Gordon Fee lays this out and says we need to go back to the lexicon and see how this term is properly used. And it's not used in a pejorative way. It's a term speaking, all three are participles. It's speaking of somebody of great influence. And Paul realizes this. But some of your English translations make it look like Paul's looking down on them. They seem to be this. And they possibly could be that, as if there's a possibility they would not be that. I don't think that's the way at all it should read. The NLT does probably one of the better jobs and translating that particular participle in chapter 2, verse 6 and 9. But when I look at this here, I notice Paul was concerned because he doesn't want to be running in vain. I don't want to be out here ministering to Antioch, and meanwhile I've got all these people in Jerusalem who are saying, hey, that gospel that they're preaching up there, there's a division here. There's a problem here. I can't be doing this. I'd be doing this in vain. Not that the gospel is wrong, but that the ministry would be in conflict with Jerusalem. And I don't want that conflict. So, verse 3, 4, and 5, Paul does an incredible thing. And we saw that in verse 1, but we don't get it until we get to verse 3. Paul takes one of his converts. The guy's name is Titus. And of all things, he's going to take Titus into the hotbed of Judaism, and Titus is an uncircumcised Greek. I love the way Paul thinks. See, you can't do this in email. You've got to have him right here. Here is exhibit A to my ministry. And so is Titus in private. Is before the leadership. I love to see the video replay on this one day in heaven. When you think of what took place and back and forth. And by the way, he was there for months and months. When you look at chapter 11, verse 30, and all the events of Acts 12, and then chapter 13, verse 1. I mean, there are months in here that take place. All the events of Acts 12 take place when Paul and Barnabas and Titus are there in Jerusalem. So he's there for quite some time. So we don't know how many personal encounters in private they had. Probably wasn't a single time. It was probably, let's talk, let's break, and let's talk, and let's break. It was enough time that finally, in verse number 3, he was never compelled by the leadership to be circumcised. You don't have to be like us. You don't have to go through all of those things and be like us. The gospel of grace is enough. However, verse number 4, you see something amazing. There were some brothers that are stipulated by 5 different items. Number 1, they're false brothers. Interesting. False brothers. Number 2, they're secretly brought in, false brothers. In other words, secretly brought in means there were other people in the church that were not really happy about what the apostles were doing in the church at Jerusalem. They weren't really happy about the leadership saying, okay, the Gentiles, you don't have to be circumcised. Gentiles, you don't have to obey Jewish law. This is a law-free gospel. I love it. It is a law-free gospel. And there are members in the church that after the service is over, they sort of coagulate back there, you know, and they just talk. And hey, this is something wrong. We've been like this since Moses. And now it's going to change. And they start. So then they bring in some false people secretly, it says. Thirdly, and they sneak in. It means that their actions are not like their motives. They come in and they look like brothers and they sing like brothers and they talk like brothers and they put their arms around people like brothers, but they snuck in because their motive is a lot different than what they're doing with their actions. And then he gets to the motive. They're here to spy out our freedom. It's clandestine. It's a movement of quietness that's going throughout the church in Jerusalem. There are false brothers and people who have sort of aggravated and keeping this going and fanning. There's something wrong in Antioch, and there's something wrong with our leadership, and there's something wrong with the apostles. And Paul says at the end of verse number 4, the fifth idea, they want to bring us into slavery. They want to bring us into bondage. They want to make us like them. In other words, the law-free grace, they want to get rid of the law-free. And talk about grace, but grace must be seen through the way we do things. The way we worship, it's Sabbath. The way we separate, circumcision. The way we fellowship, look at our food table. And that's how it is today. Same thing. If you don't worship like us, you can't be part of us. You don't separate like me, can't be part of us. You don't fellowship with us like I can't be part of us. Same thing. Hadn't changed. So here's Titus and Paul, because he went by revelation, the Spirit probably was behind all of this. So the text doesn't actually say that explicitly. So probably the Spirit is behind all this. And so here's Titus. And so for these months, you've got incredible difficulty going on in the church there at Jerusalem. And by the way, the apostles are the pastors. Here's the most amazing thing to me, brothers and sisters, and that's this, is that Paul goes up by revelation, but that same revelation, it was not given to the apostles in Jerusalem. It would have been very easy for the Spirit to do it email style. And that's this. Spirit comes to Cephas. Spirit comes to John, Spirit comes to James, the Lord's brother, and says to them, hey, I got this guy down here, Paul, and so he's okay. I'm going to send him up to you just so you can check him out, but he's okay. But it doesn't do that. The revelation is to Paul. And the revelation is, okay, Paul Barnabas, and take Titus, exhibit A, I want you to go up, I want you to have face to face. You see, the Spirit is at work, but we don't see the revelation going both ways. God is at work, but He wants the confrontation to take place because there's something greater than the moment. It's called the gospel of grace. It's greater than the moment. So what's so amazing is you read this personal illustration from Paul. Paul makes sure that you understand the reader, us today, that verse 5, that he would not yield to subjection to these brothers who are false. In other words, they're not saved, first of all, because it's a works salvation. They look like us, but they're not. So I didn't even yield for them, even for 1 hour. I didn't waste any time. Today we'd probably say I didn't get a second thought to them. Why? Verse 5 said, the truth of the gospel will remain with you. And then after he does that, what's so amazing, verse 6 to 10 is one sentence. And it's just grammatically like listening to something that, you know, trying to put the nouns, the verbs, trying to put the adjectives right, trying to work through this. And so all the English translations struggle. But the bottom line is when you look at verse 6 and you look at verse 7, he is saying this. I was with those men of great influence. And remember, God doesn't show partiality, verse 6. But these people of influence contributed absolutely nothing to me. They did not have to add anything to the gospel I am preaching. Verse 7, on the contrary, seeing that I have been entrusted with the gospel, some of your translations say of the uncircumcised or to the uncircumcised, we might take this as a genitive of destination for the uncircumcised. I've been entrusted with the gospel for those Gentiles, uncircumcised people, just like Peter, for the circumcision or the Jews. And verse 8, he who effectually worked for Peter and his apostleship, to the circumcised, also effectually is working with me, also to the Gentiles. I mean, we came to this amazing conclusion, verse 9. We all recognize this. Everybody came to the same conclusion in that room. All the apostles, the Spirit is sealing this. We came to the conclusion that the grace that had been given to me, what I am doing, James and Cephas and John, as leaders and pillars in the church, reached out their right hand. Sorry, all those of you that are left-handed. Reached out their right hand to us. It's actually a term that goes back to Homer, according to Fee. Has nothing to do with really the right or the left. It means that when they shook hands, their word was gold. We will see in you, Brother Paul and Paul. We see in you, Cephas, James, and John. We see in you, you both are, you've got the gospel. You all have the gospel. And there is no division between us. This has been an excellent meeting together over these months. This is tremendous. But, verse 10. There's something I want you to remember. I want you to remember to take care of the needs of the brothers and sisters. You see, that was very important when you look at Acts 2 and Acts 4. You will see that. And if we have time, we'll get there. I doubt we'll get there, but it's there. In the early church, you'll see how need after need after need after need was met in the Jerusalem church. And it was a need that caused the eruption in chapter 6 of Acts, where the widows were seemingly neglected and they had to straighten that thing out. But this is very important to people of grace that they are tender towards those who have need. So, how do I apply all this? Okay, let me give you three applications in about 7 minutes. Can I do that? All right, number one, this is very, very important. You've already received some application as I've been preaching. I know. As you understand what the text says and what the text means, I understand. Yes, you are getting application from that. But let me just give you three quick points that I think are important and must help us as a church if we're going to be a grace church. And significantly, here it is. Number one, there is no other message to take to the nations in the gospel of grace. This is both. This is both a theological fact and a personal responsibility. It's a theological fact, meaning it comes from God. It is written down. It's in the Word. This cannot be changed. But it doesn't stop here. It comes to our hearts. This is our responsibility. Jesus said in Acts 1:8, okay, here's the truth. Now, what you need is endowment from on high, the power of the Spirit of God. And when you get the endowment on high from the power of God, you will become witnesses unto me to Jerusalem, to Judea and Samaria, and you will go to the ends of the earth. Because the gospel is not just a theological fact. It is a personal weight that needs to be liberated from my lips to my neighbor, from the neighborhoods to the nations. Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, the ends of the earth. Basil Miller, in his work on William Carey, father of modern missions, writes this. In the second chapter, this is what he writes. William Carey is now in his early 20s. By the way, William Carey is the father of modern missions, okay? He's in his early 20s. Over the door of his shoe shop, he was a cobbler. So it's called Dreaming from a Cobbler's Bench. That's the title of this chapter. Dreaming from a Cobbler's Bench. From his shop, which is now preserved at a college in Regent Park, though partly illegible, it reads, quote, "Secondhand shoes bought and sold." Over Carey's workbench in this humble shop was a crude map, which William's hand had made of broad sheets of paper that he pasted together. On this map, he drew with a pen the outline of the known nations of the world and had written in the facts that he had gleaned about them from his extensive reading. He was an incredible reader. Thomas Scott, one of the best friends of William Carey, called Carey's cobbler shop, quote, "Carey's College." As he sat at his workbench by the window where he could see his beloved garden, Carey would study in Latin and in Greek and in Hebrew, and then at other times he began to add more and more languages. He borrowed books from anyone who would lend them and starved himself to buy books whenever the opportunity offered. That's how he begins chapter 2. And I do that because 8 years later, and you can get this on the internet. So there he is, a good thing on the internet. 8 years later, he's 31 years old. He's now a pastor. He's moved from a shoe cobbler to a pastor in the area of a small church, and he has a great burden for the mission field. So in 1792, he stands before his Baptist brothers who had no concern about the nation, and he hands them an 87-page manuscript he had written by hand. And he hands it to him. He says, okay, this is our meeting. I want to read this to you. And by the way, here is the title of his manuscript, quote, "An Inquiry into the Obligations of Christians to Use Means for the Conversion of the Heathens, in which the religious state of the differing nations of the world and the success of former undertakings and the practicability of further undertakings are now considered by William Carey." End of title. He has five sections. Section 1, he takes Matthew 28, 18 to 20 and shows how this must relate to the 18th century. Section 2, he goes back to Acts and shows how Paul made it work in his day. Section 3, he surveys all the countries of the world. Now, mind you, he has never been out. He has only been reading. And he gives a survey of the countries of the world and their size by, this is the length and the breadth. Mileage. Here are the populations. Here are the religious preferences. And he does this. And if you go online, you can click onto this and you'll just go page after page after page after page. And he has all of this data, page after page of data of the worlds at that time. He even calculates the number of people who live in the world and how many are pagan and how many are Christian. Basically, 2/3 of all the people are unsaved pagan people, according to Carey. And then he says this, and I'll stop there, section 3. Section 4, how to send missionaries. Section 5, we should send missionaries. But here's what he writes. He writes this, "In many of these countries, they have no written language, consequently no Bible, and they are only led by childish customs and traditions. We must do something." 1792. You see, it hasn't become personal because for us, church is an event. It's not a way of life. It's not a way of life. Missions is something we do, and we may or may not participate, or it's very easy to throw dollars at that and then soothe our conscience. But you see, when I look at what's happening here, Paul's heart was this. It's not just a theological fact, but it's going to move me from Antioch into Jerusalem because it is personal. It's personal. Second thing I think is extremely important for us, and that's this. Strong churches inevitably have false brothers and sisters in their community. There are false people right here. every strong... You think the church of Jerusalem with all the apostles and all the leaders and all the teachers and everything that had happened in Jerusalem, I mean, everything in the first century there, and they have false brothers, secret meetings and all of these things taking place because for some reason, Satan hates grace. He just hates grace. So whatever you say, we are people of grace. He despises that. Just look at the religions in the world. More people will go to hell because of religion than paganism ever dreamed. He loves it when people are involved in religions. Strong churches will have false brothers and sisters. They aren't true believers. They're here because mom and dad make them. They're here because of what other people might think. They're here because they are trying to make some connections. Number three, the third thing, and that's this. People of grace are tender to brothers and sisters who are in need. You know, it's rare that somebody ever invests money for the sake of helping somebody and they'll never receive the benefit of that. Do you ever hear about that? But it's very rare for people who would invest something for the sake of helping the poor, which thing we always do. Maybe I could just share Acts 2 with you. So here they are. They are getting the word. They've been saved. They're getting the word, the apostles' teaching and fellowship and breaking of bread and prayers. And then it says after that in verse 43, as you begin to work your way through the text, I mean, great awe comes upon all the people, and people in the church start selling things and helping people as they have needs. Chapter 4, the same thing, as they have needs. I mean, people did not need a deacon's offering to do that, though they did have that. People are just sensitive to one another. Hey, guy needs a car. Help him get a car. Hey, guy needs some work on... Help him out. There's a single mom over here. She's really struggling. Let's help her out. I mean, that's grace in action. And Satan hates it. So he can't take grace from you. So he blinds you to how grace is to respond to the community. So we don't respond to missions, though we're a grace church. And we don't just respond to our brothers and sisters because we're a grace church. See, he blinds us. So that's why I like this passage of Scripture. Grace transforms not just my actions. It begins with my heart. It changes my heart. The gospel matters. Imposters are going to be everywhere. But when they see a church really ministering as it should, hey, let me tell you, brothers and sisters, Comes alive. Why don't you stand with me here? I got a song I think would be good for us to sing. Edward, could you put up there, Beneath the Cross of Jesus. Beneath the cross I find a place to stand. And I wonder at such mercy. I just wonder. The word wonder is not to sit back and go, ooh, I wonder. It's just I'm overwhelmed. I'm amazed at the mercy that has been bestowed upon me. It calls me just like I am. So this is how we sing, beneath the cross of you. This is where I stand. Let's sing these three verses and I'll come back.